Welcome to Already Perfect, the Seattle Soto Zen podcast. And I needed a push to get me to see wherever I
Good morning. Oh dear. What? Sorry, I've got an error message popping up. I think I got rid of it though. Thank you. Sorry. There's a problem with my Microsoft account. So, just one of the things that happens in the virtual Zendo that's not so much of an issue in a physical Zendo. And another thing is cats. You've all met my fluffy black cat since we've moved to Zoom in the pandemic. At least Beauregard. We have two fluffy black cats, Beauregard and Humphrey. But they're very hard to tell apart. You've probably met Beauregard at least because Humphrey's a little bit more shy. I remember I heard someone say that the reason cats, like domestic cats, are so neurotic is they're really exquisite predators, as is obvious from anyone who's ever seen a cat. However, they're also quite small, so they have to be, you know, bold to hunt prey, but they also have to be cautious that something else isn't hunting them while they're out hunting. So it's not that other prey animals are not neurotic. I mean, anyone who has met a horse knows. But at least for horses, you know, while they're scanning for danger, they don't have to worry about the grass getting away from them. So I mention this because I wonder if there is some a similar kind of process going on with why human beings are so neurotic. I mean, compared to cats, we're also very successful predators, but we're obviously not built for it like they are. I mean, just look at our nails and teeth, for example. So, you know, we had to invent tools to make up for this obvious deficit. And in order to make tools, we had to evolve these big brains. And that was kind of a disaster. I mean, obviously we're a very successful species, but we also get ourselves into a lot of trouble. And even more troublesome, we are very social animals. We need other human beings to accept us and admire us. You know, it's not enough to be, you know, have food, shelter, and safety. We also have to be accepted and admired by other members of our species, which, you know, is not so easy to accomplish because humans tend to be kind of neurotic and difficult to deal with. I've never actually studied psychology. I signed up for a psychology course. I studied math and computer science, and I took psychology as an elective in my second year because I thought it would be an easy credit compared to the math and computer science courses I was taking. But it turns out you actually have to study to pass the psych midterm, and I didn't study, so I failed the midterm and then dropped the class. But I have talked to others and teachers who did study psychology. And apparently one of the reasons why humans tend to be unhappy is that our brain has a negativity bias. What a negativity bias means is that it is much easier for us to notice, to pay attention to, and to recall negative experiences than it is for us to notice, pay attention to, and recall positive experiences. And, you know, from an evolutionary point of view, that kind of makes sense. In Buddhism, there's a very popular metaphor of mistaking a rope for a snake. So, which is about imaginary fears. However, this is not a terrible strategy if you happen to live somewhere where there are venomous snakes around. So, I mean, if you guess wrong one way and you think a snake is a rope and yank on it, you'll get bitten and die. But if you think a rope is a snake and run away from it, you'll just be embarrassed. So obviously, people who made our ancestors who made one mistake were more likely to have offspring than the ancestors who went wrong the other way. Which means that, you know, anxiety is kind of baked into our existence. It's, you know, and again, pretty good strategy in a lot of circumstances. But again, we've got these really big brains, which means that a lot of the snakes we're running away from, they're not even coils of rope. They're ideas that have no relationship to our, you know, consensus reality. Things that never happened and will never happen. And, you know, conspiracy theories on Facebook. So, you know, the paranoia and anxiety that were adaptive when you stand a reasonable chance of running into a venomous snake in the course of your day-to-day existence get very, very bad for you when your own mind is constantly traumatizing itself with imaginary threats. And of course, the other thing is, since we are such a social animal, we need to be accepted and admired by other human beings. Just being embarrassed is its own catastrophe. So even if it's an adaptive mistake, we can't just shrug it off because somebody else might have seen it and think we're silly. So that's kind of the bad news for us, is the negativity bias of our brain. It's instinctual and easy to be frightened and unhappy, but it tends to take a conscious effort to be happy. which is, you know, a little bit unfortunate. So what do we do? I think I've mentioned before how much I was influenced in my youth by the writings of Kurt Vonnegut Jr. So there's a story he tells. My Uncle Alex, who is up in heaven now, one of the things he found objectionable about human beings was that they so rarely noticed it when times were sweet. We could be drinking lemonade in the shade of an apple tree in the summertime, and Uncle Alex would interrupt the conversation to say, "If this isn't nice, what is?" So I hope that you will do the same for the rest of your lives. When things are going sweetly and peacefully, please pause for a moment and then say out loud, "If this isn't nice, what is?" More recently, I've been equally influenced by Brother David Stanlerust. He's a Benedictine monk. I met him at Tassajara, and he does a lot of teaching and writing on gratefulness. He has a website on, I think it's called the Gratefulness Project or gratefulness.org or something. He says, "There is something you know about me, something very personal. And there is something I know about every one of you that is central to your concerns. There is something we know about everyone we meet anywhere in the world. And that is that all of us want to be happy. How we imagine our happiness, that differs from one another. But it's already a lot that we have in common, that we all want to be happy. Now, my topic is gratefulness. What is the connection between happiness and gratefulness? Many people would say that's very easy. When you are happy, you are grateful. But think again. Is it really the happy people that are grateful? We all know quite a number of people who have everything that it would take to be happy, and they are not happy because they want something else or they want more of the same. And we all know people who have lots of misfortune that we would not want to have. And they are deeply happy. They radiate happiness. Why? Because they are grateful. So it is not happiness that makes us grateful. It is gratefulness that makes us happy. So what do we mean by gratefulness? I appeal to your own experience. Something is given that is valuable to us, and it's really given. These two things have to come together. It has to be something valuable, and it's a real gift. You haven't bought it. You haven't worked for it. You haven't earned it. It's just given to you. And when these two things come together, then gratefulness spontaneously arises in my heart, and happiness spontaneously rises in my heart. The key to all this is that we can only experience it once in a while. We cannot only have grateful experiences. But we can be people who live gratefully. And how can we live gratefully? By experiencing, by coming aware that every moment is a given moment, as we say. It is a gift. You haven't earned it. You have no way of assuring there will be another moment given to you. And yet that is the most valuable thing that can ever be given to us. This moment with all the opportunity that it contains. If we didn't have this present moment, we wouldn't have any opportunity to do anything or experience anything. And this moment is a gift. It's a given moment, as we say. He goes on to say, does this mean that we can be grateful for everything? Certainly not. We cannot be grateful for violence, for war, for oppression. And on a personal level, we cannot be grateful for the loss of a friend, for unfaithfulness, for bereavement. But I didn't say that we can be grateful for everything. I said that we can be grateful in every given moment for the opportunity. And even when we are confronted with something that is terribly difficult, we can rise to this occasion and respond to the opportunity that is given to us. It isn't as bad as it may seem. Actually, when you look at it and experience it, you find that a lot of the time, what is given to us is an opportunity to enjoy. And we only miss it because we are rushing through life and we are not stopping to see the opportunity. If this isn't nice, what is? So how can we find a method that will harness it? It's so simple that it's actually what we were told as children when we learned to cross the street. Stop, look, go. That is all. But how often do we stop? We rush through life. We miss the opportunity because we don't stop. We have to get quiet and we have to build stop signs into our life. When I was in Africa some years ago and then I came back, I noticed clean water. Where I was in Africa, we didn't have drinkable water. When I came back, every time I turned on the faucet, I was overwhelmed. It made me so happy. But after a while, this wears off. So I put little stickers on the water faucet. And every time I turned it on, I remembered to be grateful for the clean water. And when you stop, the next thing is to look. Open your eyes, open your ears, open your nose. Open all your senses for this wonderful richness that is given to us. There's no end to it, and that is what life is all about. To enjoy what is given to us. And then we can also open our hearts for the opportunities also to help others, to make others happy. Because nothing makes us more happy than when all of us are happy. And when we open our hearts to the opportunities invite us to do something, and that is the third. Stop, look, and then go. And really do something. And what we can do is whatever life offers us in the present moment. Mostly it's the opportunity to enjoy, but sometimes it's something more difficult. Of course, in Buddhism, we call this mindfulness, this stop, look, go, this remembering to pause and to pay attention to what's happening in this moment and then to respond appropriately. And, you know, again, it's something very simple, but it's also something we have to work at. It's not a thing that comes naturally all the time. Yeah, so last week, I shared a teaching by Gil Fronsdal on cultivating compassion. So under certain conditions, compassion will arise spontaneously in my heart. And through mindfulness and meditation practices, I can also consciously bring it forth. I can cultivate it. I can create the conditions where it will arise more frequently, more easily. I don't have to wait for it to happen by accident. I can actually, you know, consciously tend to compassion and the causes of compassion within my own mind, within my own life. And, you know, the same for things like gratitude. Now, Brother David's recipe for that, he says, we have experienced moments of gratefulness, And therefore, we know from within the attitude we want to repeat and maintain. We have already explored this and come to recognize that prayer and thanks come from the same root, from the heart. It is to those peak experiences of the heart that we must go back if we want to live gratefully. But what does it mean to go back to an experience? There are two ways of going back. One makes us draw new strength from the past, the other makes us shrivel up. What makes a difference? If I recall a past experience in order to clutch it and suck the last drop of sweetness from it, it will yield nothing but disappointment. If, on the other hand, I recall the same experience merely to celebrate it, to single it out, to hold it up, and to marvel at it once again, it will nourish me again and again. This is how I suggest we recall the moments in which our heart was wakefully alive. And again, if left to its own devices, our minds tend to naturally turn to more negative experiences, because that was an adaptive strategy at the time when our minds were evolving. So we have to work on it. You know, when we treat it not like, you know, and something that arises accidentally when things are going our way, but as, you know, a muscle that we can strengthen, then we can approach it as a practice, you know, as something that we can work with and work on and enrich our lives and be more helpful to others as well. And I think part of the problem, as Matthieu Ricard says in his book called, surprisingly enough, Happiness, says, the most common error is to confuse pleasure for happiness. Pleasure is a direct result of pleasurable sensual, aesthetic, or intellectual stimuli. The fleeting experience of pleasure is dependent upon circumstance, on a specific location or a moment in time. It is unstable by nature, and the sensation it evokes soon becomes neutral or even unpleasant. When repeated, it may go insipid or even lead to disgust. Savoring a delicious meal is a source of genuine pleasure. But once we're full, we're indifferent to it, and we would get sick of it if we continued eating. Pleasure is exhausted by usage, like a candle consuming itself. It is almost always linked to an activity and naturally needs to boredom by dint of being repeated. Listening rapturously to a Bach prelude requires a focus of attention that, minimal as it is, cannot be maintained indefinitely. After a while, fatigue kicks in and the music loses its charm. Were we forced to listen to it for days on end, it would become unbearable. Unlike pleasure, genuine flourishing may be influenced by circumstances, but isn't dependent on it. It doesn't mutate into its opposite, but endures and grows with experience. It imparts a sense of fulfillment that in time becomes second nature. Authentic happiness is not linked to an activity. It is a state of being, profound emotional balance struck by subtle understanding of how the mind works. One intrinsic aspect of it is selflessness, which radiates from within rather than focusing on the self. One who is at peace with herself will contribute spontaneously to establishing peace within her family, her neighborhood, and society at large. In brief, there is no distinct relationship between pleasure and happiness. But there is no reason to deprive ourselves of the enjoyment of a magnificent landscape or the scent of a rose. Pleasures become obstacles only when they upset the mind's equilibrium and lead to an obsession with gratification or an aversion to anything that thwarts them. So that's a problem, right? You know, Paul Haller would say, you know, it's simple. If I get what I want, then everything is going well. But that's, you know, really not going to happen all the time. And we, you know, we can't, just like, you know, Brother David says, we can't be grateful for everything. We can't be happy about everything that happens to us. You know, if we lose our job or if we lose a friend, that's, you know, really sad. And there's no, it's not helpful to deny that or turn away from it. And at the same time, even though we can't be happy about everything, if we look for happiness, we can find it in every moment, even when things are really, really terrible. Which doesn't mean that I've failed if I'm unhappy. As again, that's just the way the mind works. And I think it's maybe we have a few extra obstacles to happiness. Yeah, in the culture in which we all live right now. It's what Tim Burkett calls the trance of unworthiness. It seems like our society sort of fosters this dissatisfaction and self-blame. You know, Sharon Salzberg, in a conversation with the Dalai Lama, said, there is a strong belief among some Westerners that evil lies at the very center of a human being. This is very different from the Buddhist understanding that the natural state of the mind is radiant and pure, and that the defilements that create so much suffering only visit us and are not inherent in the mind. The Chinese term for this is, they call it guest dust, which is usually translated as adventitious defilements, which manages to be a translation that's even more confusing than the literal one. I would like to ask you about the mind state, very common in Westerners, of strong hatred towards the self. In Theravada Buddhism, we teach that the strongest cause for loving kindness is to see the goodness in somebody, but often people say they cannot see their own goodness. When we ask people to reflect on good things they have done in the past so that their mind is filled with joy, self-respect, and confidence, they say they cannot easily do this. They can easily recall the bad things they have done, but not the good. Because people so often express that they can feel love and compassion for other beings more easily than for themselves, what does it mean to teach sacrificing the self for others? For these people, the emphasis on self-sacrifice is not seen as true loving kindness, but simply as more self-contempt and unworthiness. Sometimes, Your Holiness, there's another component as well. It's not just that people wish to be happy and aren't. They wish to be happy, but feel like they don't deserve to be. They feel guilty as if it would somehow be wrong for them to be happy. So how can we teach loving kindness and compassion while talking very specifically about loving oneself? And quite famously, this very much confused the Dalai Lama because he was not raised in an environment where this really happened very much. You know, I guess we find our different ways to suffer in different societies, right? And our particular way of suffering is this trance of unworthiness, this feeling that not only am I unhappy, if by accident I stumble on happiness, I need to reject it because I'm not worthy of it. Because I'm such a bad person, I shouldn't allow myself to feel it. So, Tim Burkett wrote a book, Zen in the Age of Anxiety. And he talks about, he has a whole chapter on the trance of unworthiness. And he says, when I was living at Tassajara Zen Mountain Monastery, certain days were designated on free days. On one of those free days, I met with Suzuki Roshi to grumble about the way things were going. We had to wear robes, even though we weren't ordained, and robes were difficult for me. I stepped on them every time I stood up from my cushion. Another problem was the introduction of a ritualized meal servants called oryoki. It involved nested bowls wrapped up and tied in several layers of linen and a series of chants to memorize. The meal unfolded in orchestrated stages. It was beautiful, but I wasn't good at ritual. So I was pissing and moaning because I felt awkward and clumsy. Suzuki Roshi responded by saying, "You are perfect just as you are." What a relief. I didn't have to worry about my robes or mastering oryoki because I was perfect as I was. So I spent the rest of my free day hiking around the streams and hills above Tassajara. My teacher recognized that I was becoming fixated on ideas about how I should be and how my practice should be. Through his kindness, I was able to relax into what was happening in my practice, and I experienced some openness. Once we're open, we're resilient. Only then can practice continue. However, Suzuki's lesson for me that day was not finished. When I came back to my little cabin that afternoon, he motioned me over. I immediately started telling him about my day, how wonderful it was. He listened patiently. Then he said, "But Tim, you could use a little improvement in the way you take care of things. You are perfect as you are, but you can use a little improvement," has become one of Suzuki Roshi's best known quotations. It exemplifies his skillfulness as a teacher. If you just go with the first part, "you're perfect as you are," you're probably flaking out on your commitments. If you just go with the second part, "you could use a little improvement," you're probably beating yourself up around some idea of who you should be. You need both. The openness, non-judgmental awareness, and kindness that Suzuki embodied are aspects of our original nature. These qualities arise naturally when the mind becomes still through regular meditation. This is the key for dissolving the trance of unworthiness. Last week, I quoted Gil Fronstall as saying that we are not obligated to be compassionate. And afterwards, some of you took exception to that. So I think actually we are obligated to be compassionate. I mean, isn't that why we practice Zen for, right? Isn't that the whole point? But I agree with Gil. I think that we actually are not obligated. That compassion isn't a chore or a test. It's not like if you do your compassion practices and you can play Xbox. Or if you can be compassionate for this terrible person in the news, then you're a good person. And if you can't be compassionate for him, then you're a bad person. You're a bad Buddhist. I think, you know, again, it's a cultivation practice and a mindfulness exercise. You know, we notice when we're paying attention that thinking and behaving in a more compassionate way is beneficial to myself and to the people around me. So it's not about forcing ourselves or obligating ourselves to feel a certain way on the spot. It's to pay attention. What's it like when I'm grateful? When I'm kind? When I'm able to stop and open up and allow the world to delight me? When the myriad things come forth and experience the self, that's enlightenment. Right? When I can open myself up to surprise and delight, even in the midst of the drudgery of my everyday life. And I'm an accountant, so I know drudgery. And, you know, and what happens to my physical, intellectual, and emotional state when I do the opposite? When I'm sleepwalking through life, when I give way to anger, when I don't pay attention. I keep going back to the book Seeds for a Boundless Life by Zenkei Blanche Hartman. I think there was a point last year when I gave a quote every week from this book. So you've probably heard the entire book by now, but this is a section from a Dharma talk called Gladdening the Mind. I didn't realize that I was making myself miserable with my thinking, completely escaped my notice until one day when I was in Sesshin at Green Gulch Farm and was on my way to the Zendo. I passed a pond that is right next to the Zendo. It was early morning, the twilight of morning, which is a time that I'm very fond of. The mist was rising from the pond, and there was a great blue heron on the shore. It was a beautiful morning, as sometimes happens at Green Gulch. I went into the Zendo feeling really, really good. And a little while later, I was feeling really, really bad. And I thought, wait, nothing's happened. I've just been sitting here. I've just been thinking. I did this all to myself. How did I do that? I'd been telling myself an old sad story. And I thought, wait a minute. I don't know. I don't want to go there anymore. If I did it to myself, then I'm going to stop doing that. And as I continued sitting, pretty soon that old sad story came up again. And I said to myself, oh, I don't want to get on that train. That train takes me to hell and I don't want to go there. You can use whatever metaphor comes up for you that will help you spot an unskillful thought and drop it. I had an image once of moving a piano and putting it down on my foot. Well, if I don't want the piano on my foot, I shouldn't put it there. Find whatever image will help you laugh at yourself a bit instead of beating yourself up for having such thoughts. You could congratulate yourself for noticing the thought so that now you can let it go. I can get into criticizing myself a lot, but it's more effective if I congratulate myself for doing something right than if I hit myself over the head for doing something wrong. So I switched to saying, oh, good, I noticed, now I can stop, instead of, oh, bad, I'm doing it again. That is very helpful. It allows me to notice sooner, because instead of getting hit with a stick, I'm getting a little pat on the back from the person who matters most to me, myself. So, you know, if we let our minds wander unsupervised, we'll naturally return to these sad old stories. And just like our hearts will naturally open to people we perceive as being like us and turn away from people we perceive as being different. And that's not a judgment. It's just something that's useful for me to know about the way my mind works, because I'm human. And when I know that, I can remember, oh, right, I was taking up a practice to cultivate compassion and gratitude and joy. Right, I was making an effort to do something different from what my mind and heart do when I'm not paying attention and let them wander around unsupervised. And again, as Brother David says, you know, we can't and we shouldn't be grateful for everything. But in every moment, we can find something to be grateful for. And if it's a struggle, of course it is, because that's the way we're humans and that's the way our minds work, right? That's why this is a practice. You know, that's why we sit so much zazen. If it were easy, we wouldn't have to sit for 40 minutes to do it. But it, you know, it takes that long to quiet our mind enough so that we can open ourselves up to these opportunities for compassion and gratitude and joy. I want to close with Kurt Vonnegut again. I think this was from a graduation speech he gave. Show of hands, please. How many of you have had a teacher at any stage of your education, from first grade until today, who made you happier to be alive, prouder to be alive, than you had previously believed possible? Good. And he says, to say the name of that teacher to someone sitting next to you. But for today, I'm going to ask you to type it into the chat. I'll go first. All done. Thank you. Drive home safely and God bless you all, is what Kurt Vonnegut says. And I say, thank you very much for your kind attention. Please take very good care of yourselves. And I needed a push to get me to see wherever I am, I'm already free.
Thank you for listening. Please find us at seattlesotozen.org. Our theme music is by Stuart Davis. Gosho!